welcome to Middle Age Geeks, the podcast where we aim to discuss movies, video games, TV shows, and anything else geeky that takes our fancy. My name is Phil, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Daz. Daz, how are you?
I'm very good, my man. Very good indeed. And how are you? How's yourself?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm really enjoying these. I'm really enjoying this. The idea of getting into this kind of 1999 buzz. This episode is the second part of our Party Like It's 1999 series. So last week we discussed Green Mile, which was fun to revisit, and we'll be doing 99 classics for the next few weeks. So during this episode, Daz will be taking us through The Incredible Fight Club. And then for our retro corner, we'll be going through Donkey Kong 64. But before we get into that kind of classic era section, Daz, it'll be interesting to know what you've been playing and watching for the past week.
There's a nice mix. Myself and my wife have been getting through True Detective, the season 4, which is wonderful. Fantastic setting in Alaska, it's so fucking creepy, and it must have been maybe the end of the first episode, or when it just revealed its kind of horror elements. Myself and my wife looked at each other. We're not really big horror fans. We're just like, fuck it, no, it's horror. And we signed up for this. And, you know, once you're in for a penny, in for a pound. So by episode 4, yeah, things really fucking kick off. And it's scary and terrifying in a way without cheap jump scares, as we've talked about before. It's just the eerie setting is fantastic. Like, Alaska is just a creepy fucking place. Like, imagine just having whatever it is, 30, 40 days a night or whatever around Christmas. But Jodie Foster's fantastic. John Hawkes is wonderful as ever. It's dark, unsettling, and fucking love it. Like, Foster's brilliant. She's just an asshole of a character. Like,
how many episodes are there into it? Like, I've watched
There's only six. I thought it was 10.
Oh, okay. And it's 4 episodes in so far, is it?
The fourth one was last night, I think.
Okay. I'll try and catch up with that during the week. Shame, I loved the first two, yeah.
Yeah, I'd easily watch 10 episodes of this. Absolutely. But when it's only 6, it's a shame, but it's also nice. It means you can move on to the next thing. But offset that, good show. As I was talking to you, I recently got like a Fire Stick, and I was going through different apps and bits and bobs and trying to set up the TV shows on it and favorites and all that, mainly for my daughter. But I came across Quantum Leap, and I was like, oh, fucking no, Quantum Leap's on this. But it's the reboot or whatever from, I don't know when it was, 2022 or something. And it's fucking shocking. Like, I had no intention of, I said, like, if I get through half of this episode, I'd be impressed. But it's lacking everything. They missed the mark. They don't even know what they're rebooting. It's not funny. It's the attempt at humor is laughable. The cast is terrible. Turned it off after about 25 minutes. But sometimes it's good, just like, you know, a game where you test it for an hour or something and just go, oh, no, not for me. Like, I knew this was not for me, so turned it off. It's fucking horrible. On the gaming front, I kind of finished Prince of Persia. I finished it in terms of...
Oh, nice.
I'm kind of done playing it. I got to a boss and I just couldn't get past it and realized that, like, you can turn on a few assists, but you can't actually change the difficulty in that playthrough. I'm about 13 hours in, and it was one of those bosses, like, you and me both know, like, back in the day, we would love kind of, you know, studying the different attacks and kind of go, right, okay, that's the trigger. That's a sign he's going to do such and such attack. But I just didn't have the time, and it's a shame because it's a wonderful game. But someone said online, oh, you might have to go back to a previous save and then change your weapons and your enchantments and all that stuff. And I was like, fuck that. Just couldn't be bothered. And I mainly couldn't be bothered because, shock her, I've been playing Suicide Squad.
Oh, really?
Well, I had to fight the urge to send you a few screenshots of this fucking thing. And before you ask, yeah, I didn't pay for it. A good friend of mine, a friend of the show, Alan, lent me his copy. And Yeah, it's pretty much it's as bad as they say. You know, it's I played for about 4 hours. I think it's about 12-hour runtime in the main campaign. But you know, the positives first. Obviously, it looks really great for the most part. You know, but even putting it side by side with Arkham Knight, you know, there's not that much difference in graphics apart from, you know, fidelity and 4K, which is a bit alarming. Like the cutscenes are obviously showcase the power of next gen. They're fucking phenomenal, and the performances are great, and the dialogue is great. But yeah, the cutscenes are great to a point, because the whole story so far is played out through the cutscenes, because the mission design is so fucking pedantic. You know what I mean? It's the game is exactly 90% of what they showed. You know, with those fights on the top of rooftops against enemies with purple fucking orbs and whatever. That's 90% of what I've played so far. And you even have missions. I've had 4 missions where there's this slow moving vehicle, just for some reason moving really slow through the city that you have to protect. And it's kind of, they try and set it up in a cutscene, but it's just like, why is this moving so slowly through? This is like something from 90s fucking game. It's pretty shoddy. But the characters are, like, I've played mainly with King Shark, because his dialogue is great and he's fun to play with. But the traversal elements to each one of them is kind of tricky. They all have the same kind of thing. You're just trying to fly through space and stay above the enemies and all this kind of shit. But like Harley Quinn kind of has almost like Spider-Man's web shooters. You can fire like 2 of them, but then you have to do a special kind of flip. And if you mistime it, then you just fall down to the ground and you have to launch back up and do it again. It's just a bit cumbersome. And yeah, it just doesn't showcase what 9 or 8 or 9 years of development should do. Like the mission design is just so lacking. It's like someone churned this out in 2 years, and it really says a lot about the production of this. Like the development must have just changed course completely at some point throughout this development, because it's pretty shit. Like the guns are fucking boring. You just get like your standard sniper rifle, assault rifle, shotguns, these kind of things, and you get these upgrades and perks. And this is where that live action thing really just comes in. It's ridiculous. Like you get upgrades, like there's a 0.05 boost on enemies grouped together in groups more than 3 when they're within 5 meters of you when your health is under 33%. And you just go, I don't fucking care. Like it's just numbers. Everything is just fucking numbers. But I am going to complete it, because I've seen someone online said like it's almost worth completing it just to see how fucking terrible the ending is. No one was giving away spoilers, but they just said like the ending is supposed to be shocking in terms of it being as kind of a monetary, the suits dictating where this game goes, and it's game lost in time because live service games are being cancelled left, right, and center. And there's this in the middle of it, and it a lot of the time when you're playing, like, because some of the gunplay is kind of fun at the start, but then when you realize that everything you have in the first hour, I haven't changed anything by hour 4, nothing at all, changed no weapons, because just like it's working on these enemies because it levels up with you. But yeah, it's fucking horrible. It's a chore, but I will get through it.
A fucking damn shame. You know, when we heard Rocksteady were making a new game, it's just absolutely all over, and I couldn't wait. And then when the two kind of got a release or announced quite close to each other, Gotham Knights and this, I figured, I really didn't think Gotham Knights would be the one I'd be looking at going, actually, that's the one I'd rather fucking play. But it actually is. Now, I haven't played it yet. It's on Game Pass, and I've been putting it off because it does look shit, but I'm glad it still appeals to me more than this. I think A Game at a Time really sums it up pretty well. I'd be surprised. You know, I think I mentioned this to you, like this, Rocksteady aren't a huge publisher. You know, the Arkham games are mostly all they've put out. So if this absolutely tanks, this could really hurt them, you know, because they haven't got revenue stream coming in from other games that they've got out there. So it's really worrying that this is the direction they chose for this game. And like, there's so much you could do with the Suicide Squad because the characters are bad guys, you know, so much more you can you can do, like, Batman obviously has to hold back. He doesn't kill anybody. You could have Harley Quinn going off the fucking rails. So much you could do with this. Have King Shark literally biting people's heads off. You could have gone a violent way with it or done something different. But it's just everything I've seen from it is just so off-putting. I'm not surprised.
Such a disappointment.
To hear you say that.
Such a disappointment. How about yourself? What have you been up to?
I watched some older movies because I was really upset that Carl Weathers passed.
Yeah.
So I watched a couple of old movies, but I did watch a newer movie, which was, I went to see American Fiction.
I
thought it was great. I don't know if I've ever seen a movie with Jeffrey Wright as the leading man. This might be the first movie I've seen him as the leading man. I can't think of another movie that I've seen, but he's absolutely brilliant. I think they kind of sell it in the trailer a lot more. Like, if you've seen the trailer, you know, you see that he's pretending to be real gangster or whatever, because that's what he's trying to sell this type of book and put it out there. Yeah, and they really play it up as if that's the main focus of the movie, you know, when it's not really. But no, I really enjoyed it. I felt some parts were a little unnecessary. It was kind of like a little side plot here or there, which was like, I didn't really think it was needed or added anything to the movie. But it's really, really, really well acted. It's fucking laugh out loud funny in parts. And it's just, yeah, it's a lot of fun, and it's worth it for Jeffrey Wright's performance. As I said last week, it's great to see such amazing standouts for some of these, like the awards at the Oscars coming up. Like Jeffrey Wright and Paul Giamatti and Cillian Murphy, who fucking please God wins. It's quality. Looking forward to going and seeing the Iron Claw this weekend as well.
That looks great.
Yeah, it does, man. I think Zac Efron is fucking great. Anything I've seen him in, I really enjoy it. I like that he's playing different roles. He's not just sticking to the pretty boy rom-com. Like, he was...
Yeah, yeah.
The movie wasn't amazing, but that Ted Bundy movie he was in, I thought he was really, really good.
I never saw that, actually.
It's good. Like, I don't feel there was enough told from the victim's side, but, like, it's still a good watch because it's a good performance, you know. Gaming wise, I've only played one game, and so this one passed me by. I meant to play it when it came out and it didn't, but it's been on PS Plus, and I have refused to get PS Plus because the cunts put the price up. I was like, no fucking way am I paying for it. But they were doing 33% off or 30% off or something PS Plus. Like, fuck it, I'll renew. I renewed it at what the original price I was paying. You know what I mean? But I was playing Kena, you know, Kena Bridge of Spirits. Kena, whatever it's called.
I played the first few hours of that. It's great.
It's a combat great system. Game.
Brilliant in that.
It's great. The simple enemies, the ones that you kind of just come in contact with, are a piece of piss and not really, you know, they rarely get a hit on you, you know. But I did find the kind of the tougher enemies and the bosses are a lot of fun. They're challenging and all the little fucking adorable little rots, whatever those things you collect, and they follow you around. It's good crack collecting them, the powers that you unlock, the dialogue is fun. It's a beautiful, beautiful looking game. And for that studio, I can't remember the name of the studio, but I think it's the first game they've put out as well. So it's a great effort for your first game.
Good start.
Really, really good. So that's the only thing I've played this week. I've kind of just been arsing around. But So look, with that segment out of the way, myself and Daz would like to invite you to join us for a trip back in time. You don't understand that reference, go and watch Wayne's World. So it's all the way back to 1999. The music sharing service Napster was created. Michael Jordan retired for the second, but not the last time. Britney Spears had the highest selling single of the year with Hit Me Baby One More Time. Classic. We finally got a new Star Wars movie after 16 years. Worth the wait.
That was worth the wait. Yeah.
for the last 10 minutes. Everybody was freaking out about Y2K. And it all worked out in the end. I'm sure it didn't just work out. I'm sure a bunch of people did stuff in the background to make it work out, but it all worked out in the end. And so, yeah, so Daz is going to kick us off with the movie review. So take it away, Daz.
Super duper. Thank you very much. And yeah, we were both gleaming when we decided on our movies for this month. And I think especially this week, because this is a movie that's close to both our hearts. And what a joy it is to look back at this absolute fucking masterpiece. Well, I'll set the scene. It was released in 1999, obviously, directed by David Fincher, starring Brad Pitt, Ed Norton, and Helena Bonham Carter, based on the book by Chuck Palahniuk, of the same name. It had a budget of $63 million, and it's safe to say that this is one of my all-time favorite films, in top 10 for sure, maybe around number 7 or 8. I was going through them last night. I saw this 11 times in the cinema when it came out, 4 times in one day, and that was a crazy day. That was a fucking crazy. I remember getting on a bus afterwards and just not paying, just like mind was frazzled. But yeah, and it was unlike anything I'd ever seen before, you know. And after 7 and The Game coming out, Fincher was now certainly my favorite film director around at the time. But Fight Club wasn't a success when it released. For a budget of $63 million, it made only $11 million opening weekend gross, which was a little less than predicted. But it eventually made a theatrical run of $100 million worldwide, which is still not great for $63 million. People had said it was maybe too dark or too confusing or too subversive for mainstream audiences, but there was also people saying that it was misjudged as maybe an action movie based or an action fight movie based on underground bare knuckle contest or something like that, mainly because the studio were increasingly worried about the film when they saw it, and they reduced the marketing budget down to a measly like $15 or $20 million. And David Fincher actually released, I don't know if you remember, he released two early promos in the form of like fake public service announcements.
Yeah, I think they're on the DVD. I think they're on the DVD extras, I think.
They're fucking brilliant. Ed Norton, I think, telling people that, do you know your urine is sterile? You can drink it. This kind of shit. And the studios are just like, fuck that. And they pushed the trailers to feature, obviously, fight scenes, and the marketing was aimed at Brad Pitt. And there's multiple slots pushed between like UFC bouts and WWF bouts that Fincher was fucking fuming over, just going, what are you talking about? Like, that's not our audience, but the studios didn't know what the fuck to do with this movie when they saw it.
Okay, it's categorized. When you're discussing like how would you categorize this movie, and if you look at IMDb, it's just down as drama. Nothing else. Like most movies you go in, you've got drama, sci-fi, horror, or fantasy, family, whatever the fuck it is. This is just listed as just drama. And I started to think to myself, how would I fucking categorize this movie? What headings would I give it? I'm like, I'm not fucking sure.
Just imagine what they were thinking back then. Just like I remember, like at the Fincher said that the screening, when he screened it for the executives at 20th Century Fox, that he's like felt like the air was being sucked out of the room, and he loved every minute of it. Like, but before he was involved, the directors, and I didn't know this actually, that were sought after were like obviously Peter Jackson, but he was busy doing The Frighteners at that time in 96, I think. Bryan Singer and Danny Boyle both turned it down. David O. Russell read it, and he openly said recently that he didn't even understand it, and he obviously didn't read it enough, or he just didn't get it, to his dismay, and he definitely regrets that one. Fincher tried to buy the rights to the movie, but found out that 20th Century Fox had purchased them before him. This was after he read the book, and this is obviously the same company that he fucking despised after Alien 3, and we spoke about that in our Alien episode. And he had vowed never to work with these dickheads again. These dickheads, his words, not mine. But after a meeting with them, and one of their producers, he considered returning to Fox. But he brilliantly said, there's two ways to make it. There's a $3 million way, which is just cut corners and just make your independent version of the movie. That's all well and good. Or you do the way that would do it justice, given the material, the subject matter, and that would be to invest tens of millions in it and put movie stars in it and get people to watch it and then go talk about the anti-consumerist rantings of a schizophrenic maniac, which is like, all right, fair enough. And that was how he positioned himself as the director. Like, that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to do the latter. And then he even had the gall to give them like an ultimatum of 48 hours to accept his proposal, or he was fucking out of there. Like, which is such confidence. It's one of the reasons I love him. Like, he's, David Fincher is known for his technical brilliance, you know, in doing like 70, 80 takes, but he obviously gets amazing performances out of people. But he also doesn't shy at putting a finger up to the fucking suits when it pleases him, because he had just made Seven and The Game, but especially Seven, and just like he was the go-to director around at the time. But yeah, what are your thoughts? You remember, did it bring back any memories when you were watching this again?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, you, I didn't see it as many times in the cinema, but I did see it multiple times. This, again, it's hard to categorize the movie, and I love that, like, Fincher is, both of us are massive fans, and what's a real testament to how great this movie was and how close it was to what Chuck Palahniuk said is that the movie was a better version. He said the way it was told in the movie, he reckons, is better than what he wrote in the book. But just, it's incredible. The performances are unreal. And like Brad Pitt was such a massive star at the time that he was a big get to get for. Like, he got, even the difference, the disparity in wages between the two of them, like Brad Pitt got paid $17.5 million for this movie, and Edward Norton got $2.5 million.
Yeah,
it was huge, huge difference, because it was just, but like, they're both fucking absolutely on it. Even the parts, like fucking Meatloaf is fucking fantastic.
So
in it.
Good.
It's just, the small role that Jared Leto plays as well. Like, it's just, it's Helena Bonham Carter as well is fantastic, because there was someone else who was picked for it. I can't remember. There was another actress, Reese Witherspoon. That's who the studio wanted, Reese Witherspoon. And thank fuck that she couldn't do it, because I'm sure she would have done a good job. But
she didn't want to do the nudity or something like that, and you're like, thank God.
Well, and the thing is that the nudity wasn't even Helena Bonham Carter anyway. It's absolutely outstanding. This, and what's great when you're rewatching, and obviously we've both rewatched it multiple times over the years, is to pick up on all the little parts that you missed. You know, even watching it now, I'm kind of saying, oh yeah, he kind of didn't talk to him. He talked directly to everything. It just, you start, every time you watch it, you kind of notice this, the smallest little thing, and you go, oh, Jesus, both of them are in the scene, but you just noticed he only said something to him. Or it's just the smallest little parts that it really is. So much attention is paid to everything. I think I saw one quote that says there's a Starbucks cup in every single shot. In the movie, random thing, but it's an excellent movie. Really hard, like as you said, undefinable. But it's something everybody should watch. Just even if you feel that this isn't something I might be interested in, get yourself outside your comfort zone and watch it, because it's just incredible performances, great directing. It's excellent.
Yeah, and that is our review. let's delve into it bit by bit and pick out some moments, and we can obviously discuss what it meant at the time and the themes and relevance and how it stands the test of time. But first, let's get into it. And it obviously opens with this glorious title sequence. And back in the day, obviously, Fincher, coming from his visual effects background with Lucasfilm, he's always pushing the envelope with visual effects in most of his movies. The sequences where the camera is moving through the synapses of the brain, and it kind of tracks out of the kind of brain to reveal the pores of skin and moves along the barrel of a handgun, which then you realize with a rack focus is in Edward Norton's mouth and held by Brad Pitt. And we never get the protagonist's name in the movie. He's just called the narrator, but for the sake of this review, we'll refer to him as Jack, because he refers to that in his inner monologues later on in the movie. And I think even Norton said on the DVD commentary, he just said he was called Jack on set. So, but obviously that opening scene is a flash forward to the climax of the movie, where Jack explains their dastardly plan, which is to that several high-rise buildings, credit card companies, have been rigged with explosives in the, and are set to go off in a matter of seconds. And all of this has something to do with a woman named Marla, which is just brilliantly setting the scene. And we then flash back to Norton, or sorry, to Jack, as he's in a self-help group and with his head pressed against Meatloaf's bulging chest. And as there, Ed Norton goes, "This is Bob. Bob had bitch tits." Such a glorious transition from like the crazy open into this. And you're kind of thinking, what the fuck is going on? Like, where did he get here? And then in a lovely play and in the kind of non-linear structure to begin with, Jack says, "Hold on, wait up. Let me start earlier." So he goes back and tells us that Jack has been battling insomnia for 6 months. His life is boring, meaningless. He comments that his life is just a copy of a copy of a copy. And Jack works in insurance for a car manufacturing company as a recall coordinator, I think. And he is at home, he's a slave to the IKEA catalog, spending his evenings deciding like what rug defines me as a person. And Norton actually said that it examines the value conflicts of Generation X, as the first generation raised on television, and this generation had its value system largely dictated by its advertising culture, and was told that one could achieve spiritual happiness through home furnishing. And that just drew him to the project. He's like, fucking hell, there's a sentence. But Jack visits his doctor to try and get something for his insomnia. And he tells his doctor that he's in pain. He can't get any medication, but his doctor says, "You're fine. You just need a good night's sleep." And this is actually the first of four flash frames where we get those little single frames of Brad Pitt's Tyler Durden beside the doctor, which I remember at the time, it's exactly what they say later on in the film. It's like, you saw it, but did you see it? You know, you're just, what the fuck? You're just like, is that Brad Pitt? All that? And Fincher said that it was our hero was creating Tyler Durden in his head, essentially. And that's at this point, he exists only in the periphery of Jack's consciousness. So he wanted to splice in these kind of frames. So, but his doctor tells him to swing by the men's group with testicular cancer and say, that's pain, if you want to do that. And that actually gives Jack an idea. So Jack goes to the self-help group, and that's where he meets Bob, Meatloaf's character, who, as you're saying, he's brilliant, and it's so fucking good. Like, Meatloaf plays this overweight guy with, as we said, bitch tits, who was a juicer and testosterone deficiency. And during one of their one-on-one hugging sessions, Jack's head is pushed into Bob's big tits, and he says, and then something happened. He started to cry. He said, I let go. I got lost in oblivion, and I found freedom, and losing all hope was freedom. And he said, babies don't cry this, or babies don't sleep this well. I became addicted. And that just starts off a fantastic montage of Jack going to various support groups like AA, tuberculosis, blood parasite group, kidney disease.
It's so great, the idea that we go to self-help groups to help us deal with addiction, and he's addicted to self-help groups. You know, it's so good. And again, as you said, Ed Norton is just playing it. Obviously, we'll get into it now when Marla comes into it, but he's playing it so, that part of it, so straight, as if this is the most normal thing in the world for him to go to these things. There's no guilt. This character doesn't feel any guilt for the fact that he is there, an imposter. Everybody else there is in pain and has been through stuff and supportive. He is there for his own needs. He's not there to help the other people there. He's literally just there because it's helping him soothe his soul, allowing him to sleep, allowing him to deal with his anxiety and stuff like that. And it's just, he doesn't know who he is.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's completely, he's using these self-help groups with no desire to give back to any of them. He's just addicted to it. And it's brilliant. It's such a great idea.
Yeah. And the montage just shows like lots of group hugs and free coffee and free donuts. And as you're saying, he's feeding off the misery in the room. Like, he tells Marla later on that, like, when people think you're dying, they really, really listen to you. It's like, such a dark thing, but it's like, yeah, okay, if that works. But he does, like, he utters lines like, they cried harder, so I cried harder. Every evening I died and every evening I was reborn. It's like so fucking dark. Like, and it's such a fantastic opening, and the pace of it is just draws you in so quick. We're blissfully engrossed in Jack's character from the off, even as twisted and crazy as this is. And like, I was only 19, 20 when I saw that, but I straight away kind of not identified with it, but you're just like, oh, fucking, this is great. I know exactly. Like, you think you know exactly why he's there, because he's explained so well. But I'd love to know what it was like if you were in your late 20s or late 30s or the generation that kind of really talking about it, that specific age group, to see how it would resonate, if it's resonating with, you know, you were probably a teenager when you saw it. But...
Yeah, 1992, so I was 17, yeah.
Wow. That's crazy, like. But yeah, Fincher's style comes to the fore in these early scenes. Like, his immaculate framing, I get to his framing again later on. It just blows my mind with the pacing and camera movements and the score and cinematography. We could list every single thing. It's just fucking flying at the start of this. But and how are your thoughts on watching Ed Norton in this compared to his previous roles, let's say, for yourself? Because I think it's such an understated performance in the opening.
Yeah. It is, and first of all, it's the change in him as well as what I love. Like, as you said, you start off that, and it's this selfish kind of thing. But he doesn't seem like they completely sell him as this just boring ass guy who just fucking cynical and doesn't like his job. As you said, he's living just through things. You know, it's really just items and what's the word I'm looking for? Materialistic stuff. You know, it's real. Doesn't know who he is, and so, as you said, is trying to find this thing that speaks volumes about him. How can he improve his life with some other thing, because he just doesn't know who he is? And it's his evolution throughout the movie, from this sniveling little kind of fucking dude to, as we go into it and we start getting violence and we start getting desperate and all that kind of stuff, that I love his evolution throughout the character, the desperation that changes from just this guy who's a cynic about the world, who's a little smart arse.
He's a corporate drone. And, like, yeah.
Yeah. And he's bitter about it as well, you know, and he thinks he's super clever as well. Like, he really feels that he's clever and everybody else too. It's his evolution throughout the movie it's a fucking joy to watch. And I love Brad Pitt, obviously, but it's kind of gas, as I said, when you look at the fees that each of them got for it, you're kind of like, Jesus, the studio really got their money's worth out of Ed Norton.
Disparity, isn't there? Because, I mean,
yeah,
like, these two guys were at the top of their game. They're like, they're kind of who, like, because I think the studio wanted, I think, Russell Crowe for Tyler Durden.
Yeah.
I can't remember who was rumored for Ed Norton's role, but Fincher kind of went and got them. And even when they went into production or reproduction, like, they just sat on the book and sat on the early drafts of the script for a year, pretty much. They said, just going around to Brad Pitt's house for hours every week, just fucking ironing it out. And it's just, and these guys were at the peak of their powers at the time, which is kind of fascinating. So all is going swimmingly for our dear Jack. But in one of his testicular cancer groups, he hears the pitter patter of a lady walking up the corridor, and he turns, and as we get this glorious introduction to Marla, played by Helena Bonham Carter in career best by a mile for me. Because Jack's voiceover is telling how wonderful everything is going, and then when you hear that noise, he turns and he just says, "And she ruined everything." And it's just fucking glorious. And she walks into the room, up to the camera, dressed all in black with shades on, and delivers a zinger. This is cancer, right? You know, it's like, and there we go. And it's fucking...
I think she's at the testicular cancer.
The testicular cancer, exactly, that's the whole thing. She's, this is cancer, right? And you're just going, what the... She just doesn't give a shit. Like, as she says later to him, she's just like, well, she has more right to be there than he does because she doesn't have any balls. He still has his balls, which is great. But yeah, Jack is aware that she's also a fraud, you know, a misery tourist, as they say. And she...
It's that indignation, though, isn't it? Like when he's telling her, you're a fraud, you're a misery, you're that. Like, how dare you? You're doing the exact same thing. But he's like, I'm onto you. I know the kind of person you are. It's like, it's the kind of person you are as well, you fucking bitch. He acts that indignation just comes off so well.
Because, like what he says to her, like, I need this. You know, this is my group. I need this. And he's like, you kind of asked her, like, what the fuck are you here for? And she's like, well, it's cheaper than a movie and there's free coffee. She's going, who are these people? Fucking brilliant. But like, so she upsets his whole world and then he can't release and then he can't cry and thus he can't sleep. But again, during this kind of section, we get, for me, like one of the most iconic character shots in fucking cinema, where it's camera just tracks in. It's a close-up shot of Marla, and she's in her off-kilter black hat, black shades, dressed in black with a cigarette. And the music and sound design is fucking brilliant. And she just takes a puff of the cigarette as the camera kind of tracks in on her and just lets the smoke like vacate. And just it's about 6 or 7 seconds in a 2-hour, 20-hour masterpiece, but it's my favorite shot and it's a fucking showstopper. In my book, I fucking love it. Fincher, actually, the cinematographer Fincher was using on this was, come on, his name, Jeff Cronenweth or something. And he had only done, I think, just a lot of music videos and short films and stuff like that before this. And when he got this, it's quite the gig to get, you know, because Fincher had used two different cinematographers in his last previous two movies. But this guy would eventually go on to make like 3 or 4 movies with Fincher and won the Oscar for Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Oh, sweet.
But yeah, he's fucking fantastic, fantastic cinematography. Another classic line. He says, Jack says, if I had a tumor, I'd name it Marla. The little scratch at the top of your mouth that would heal if you could just stop fucking tonguing it. He's got this, this script you could quote it for the next fucking few months. But Jack says he's been going for a year, and that's when he says that, like, when people think you're dying, they really listen to. And Marla says, yeah, like, instead of waiting for their turn to speak, sort of finishing each other's sentences. But then they decide to share the groups, and you know, you take testicular cancer on Monday, I'll take blood parasites on fucking Thursday. That's just fantastic. What are your thoughts on Marla, the character, her introduction?
Oh.
And she's so fucking good. Like,
she's great. It's kind of like this, it's almost like evil fucking Johnny Depp vibes. Like, you know, she's just one of these persons who doesn't give a rat's arse how she looks. Like, she looks gone. She looks almost like a fucking junkie, yet somehow amazingly attractive. Weird. But she just doesn't give a bollock. She's, she's very similar almost to how they play or how they dress up Tyler Durden when he's around the house, you know, when he's kind of not on the suits, when he's on the plane and all the rest of it. But they just have this, like, couldn't give a shit what I'm wearing, the pink dressing gown together, and stuff. Yeah. It's just, throwing fucking sunglasses on and the pink dressing gown around the house. It's real. She's at one point, she's wearing like a bridesmaid's dress and stuff.
Yeah.
It's just, I can't imagine anybody else playing that role. Like when we talked about last week, we talked about the Green Mile. I could see Tom Hanks as Andy Dufresne. I could see that. I know Tim Robbins was incredible, but I could see that, you know, and you can see certain times that, but I can't imagine anybody else doing this role as well as that. And she does that. She has done throughout her career, does those kind of dark and creepy things, whether it's in a fucking, you know, a Harry Potter style thing or a Sweeney Todd or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah.
She has that look about her that, you know, that lends itself to the character. And that's besides everything that she brings to the character as an actor as well, you know. Loved her. She did. I absolutely loved her in this. She was fantastic.
I read something earlier on, and I was going through some trivia bits where she asked the makeup artist to put on eyeliner with the left hand. I thought that was fucking brilliant. Like, more people should know that. It's just a little subtle thing. It's just like, not to make it crazy, but just, you know.
To show that she either doesn't care that how it looks, you know, either doesn't care or just hasn't done it enough times to fucking, she's just like, yeah, whatever, it's on, I'm going out. Like.
Yeah, yeah. So then, following the introduction of Marla, we get a montage of Jack at work. And this is like the laborious travel and airports flying all over the America and possibly the world. We're not really sure. But he talks about like checking in here, checking in there, losing an hour, gaining an hour. He describes like life on the road as like single serving sugar, single serving shampoo, single serving food and single serving friends. And it's at this where we get one of the killer lines of dialogue that has so much weight to it, considering everything that follows, where he said that, like, this is your life and it's ending 1 minute at a time. And it's just such a fucking, just a powerful one-liner. And the scene that follows that is another one of my favorites, where, especially on repeat viewings, it has so much relevance. Where it's Jack on one of those travelators in an airport, and he's just talking about, you know, waking up in a different place. And if you're on, you know, if you gain an hour, if you lose an hour, if you wake up in a different place at a different time, could you wake up as a different person? And it's such a throwaway line. And it's at that moment, that shot, as he says that, there's a shot kind of tilts up on the travelator thing to show Jack as he says that. And then it just pans across, and on the other side of the travelator going the other way is Tyler Durden. And it's like, and that's pretty much the moment where he's come to fruition. He has been created. And it's so symbolic and so visual. And it's just on repeat viewings, it's like, oh, fucking hell. You know, it's just really, really fucking.
You wonder, like, if Marla hadn't come along, you know, if Marla hadn't come along, if he kept getting this release that he was getting from going to these groups, would Tyler Durden have ever come in to
fruition?
As he was bubbling in the background, as you said, you get a shot, but he doesn't come. So does Marla coming into his life, and she has a line at one stage where she tells him he's the worst thing that's ever happened to her.
And you
wondered, is she the worst thing that's ever happened to him? Would, if she hadn't come on, if he could continue to live his life going to these groups and getting the release that he needs, about emotionally sleep, the whole lot, would Tyler Durden have come out?
You know? It's a good question, actually, yeah. Because it is, he's just festering around there. But I mean, if you're stuck in your bubble and you're comfortable, would you just stay there? Can you go to self-help groups for 40 years? Pretty sure.
No, not sustainable, obviously. You know, I wonder, actually, just before we move on, I wonder, because, you know, a lot of these movies happen and then it gets a spurt of fucking randos start going out and doing it. Crashers comes out and all of a sudden there's a bunch of dickheads crashing people's weddings. I wonder how many fucking self-help groups had fucking bellends who watched this movie and thought it'd be hilarious. Let's go to self-help groups. Right? Like a bunch of dudes getting high in the gaff. Going online and going, look, there's like a fucking civic center down the road, isn't it? Let's just go down and fucking, and you guarantee there was people who fucking did it.
Absolutely. Yeah, you probably have to prove your worth coming in to every session. But Jack then mentions that every time he's on a flight, when there's another plane passing by or when the plane banks, he prays for a mid-air collision. And this is where we get an insane collision kind of dream slash daydream, where they obviously tap into the budget a little bit. The camera pans.
It looks fantastic now. Still 25 years later, it looks fantastic.
And even that initial shot.
The only thing I think is aged. The only thing I think aged in this movie was some of the music. Like the opening credits looks amazing, but the music's a little bit like late 90s dance almost. Some of the score has aged a little bit, but like the effect in it, like that whole stuff on the plane, I was like, 25 years ago, man, that looks the business.
It's
still
fucking crazy, right? Like the initial shot when he just looks to his left and looks out the window and you just see the plane veering and just another plane coming straight at you. And then, the camera pans across the cabin as the shell of the plane is ripped apart and passengers and seats flying everywhere. And it's brilliant. And then Jack wakes from his daydream and we are introduced to the person sitting beside him, which is Tyler Durden. They have a chat and Brad Pitt explains that he makes and sells soap. I remember at the time, even with the promotional, like the posters and stuff, where it just had, you know, the two of them holding up soap and Fight Club. And it was just, I was at the time like, oh, I can't wait for this movie. But what the fuck is
soap got to do with it?
Ingenious marketing. But it's at this point where he's just like, he makes and sells soap, and he's like, I didn't see that coming, you know. And there's another kind of Easter egg, little throwaway line in this as well, where as they're chatting, Ed Norton looks down, and he's just like, oh, we have the exact same briefcase. Yeah. And it's just, and then just move on. It's like, that's a simple fucking line. It's brilliant. But Tyler gives him his business card. And, you know, Tyler's is exciting and brutally honest. And it's just the exact opposite of Jack. Like, it talks about why people are so calm, you know, in airplanes when they're crashing. Because, you know, the air comes down and air gets you high when you take deep breaths and stuff. And then describes how to make homemade explosives, which comes into play later on. But yeah, he's exciting. He's exotic and interesting and represents everything that Jack is not. And you can see that Jack is mildly captivated by him. What were your thoughts on Brad Pitt as an introduction? Like, he's just so fucking good in this movie. Like,
yeah, he's just so fucking cool. Like, yeah, he's so fucking cool. Like, Ed, like the clothes that he wears, that red leather jacket, badass. Like, he just looks fucking so shit cool the whole way through. Like, when he's not even trying, as I said, when he's just wearing, whether it's just a fucking t-shirt, like at one point he's wearing like a almost like one of those, like a net kind of vest fucking thing with something written on it. Like, anything he wears, like, he just looks fucking badass. Now, obviously, it's because he's a fucking good looking dude.
Yeah.
But he just looks fucking bad. Everything just comes off effortlessly cool. He gets great dialogue, and he delivers that dialogue so well. You know, a lot of times he's fucking dancing, he's bopping the whole time when he's thinking. It's just,
yeah,
he brings this excellent fucking energy to it. He almost looks to, there's almost this, like, a little bit of disdain and pity towards Ed Norton's character, which of course is the same character, but there's bit of disdain towards him, the way he talks to him on the plane about telling him, that's really clever, your single serving friend.
How's that working out for you?
Yeah, how's that working out for you? And when he gets him to just stop the foreplay and ask, you know, what do you want to stay?
Yeah, it's real. Yeah. Just the dialogue, so cool.
Yeah, he sees that part of him the same way a part of Ed Norton sees himself. Like, Ed Norton thinks he's smarter than everybody else, but at the same time, he doesn't like himself either. And it's so much of that throughout the movie. It's hard, you know, we hear fucking for hours, and we point at every time comes up. But I loved him in this role. I think fucking Brad Pitt absolutely nailed it. And their chemistry throughout is just fucking excellent. The one thing I watched in the movie going, why is there not more movies with these two actors?
Oh, stop, yeah.
Together. You know what I mean? They're just fucking fantastic. Such great chemistry.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, then Jack returns home to find his apartment has exploded due to an electrical fault. And this is our kind of gaslighting moment to the rest of pun intended, to the rest of the movie. Destruction of his apartment is kind of that world shattering event that frees him of the trappings of normal life, and it allows him to find Tyler, or more specifically allows him to develop this coping mechanism. And as we were saying, Tyler is a wolf rather than the sheep, you know, the direct opposite and pervious to social norms and doesn't care about material possessions. And it's just like, yeah, it's fantastic. So Jack pulls out Tyler's business card and calls Tyler, and they meet up for a few beers. And here we get some wonderful views, and they're two contrasting viewpoints of the world, where Jack is at a loss because he's so like pitiful and sad and mourning the loss of all his material stuff, saying, you know, things like, but I buy that table, and that's the only table I have it now, and that's the only table I'm going to have. And Brad Pitt's just like, well, you know, that's boohoo, and now it's all gone, man. But Brad Pitt's viewpoint then is just that he says we're consumers, and murder, crime, and poverty, these things don't concern me. What concerns me are celebrity magazines, reality TV shows, and someone's name on your underwear. And the things you own end up owning you. And it's perfect. It's on the nose, and it's still relevant today. And then obviously outside the bar, they get into a fight. Or more specifically, Jack asks Taylor, or Tyler propositions Jack to just cut the foreplay and asks, do you want somewhere to stay? He says, of course you can. You can stay with me, but you have to do me a favor first. And the the iconic line that the whole premise of this movie is built on, one that I've uttered to you a million times. It's brilliant. It's just like, I want you to hit me as hard as you can. And it's just fucking fantastic. We get a freeze frame and some history on Tyler, who works as a projectionist. It's one of the funniest moments you'll ever see in a fucking movie, when he splices single frame of pornography onto a children's movie. And his commentary is, you know, they don't know they saw it, but they saw it. And kids crying in the cinema and stuff. And he pisses in soup as a hotel waiter and all this kind of shit. They basically have a fight and scrap it out and start to like it. And they head home to Tyler's house. And this house is, I know from behind the scenes, like the exterior is obviously a house, but the interior must be a set, because it's the most unbelievable fucking set design you'll ever see. The decrepit, dilapidated fucking madness of it falling apart. It's a fucking absolute shithole. What did you make about these moments?
Yeah, like the gaff is like, it's like the two lads. Did you ever watch Bottom when you were younger?
Yeah.
With Rick Mayall. It was like their apartment, but in a giant house. Like the whole place is just in bits. The fucking, they have to turn the electricity off after, you know, certain times. The whole basement is flooded. Like this place is fucking, you know, absolutely in bits. And we learn more about why he's there and everything as it goes on. Mm. But it's everything is what stems from this house. Then it's what's born of this house is the, with Marla, with the others that come into the group. Because this is where, it's just shortly after this where we actually start to get the from the titular name Fight Club. You know, yeah. It's just around here is where it starts off as just the two of them. And it's just, it's all the scenes that in that house of the two of them are just pulling their fucking teeth out because they've been in the fight. They're black and blue, you know, brushing their teeth with fucking dirty water. You know, Brad Pitt's scrubbing blood off himself and walking himself in the bath while fucking What's-His-Face is sitting there, Ed Norton sitting there reading in the book in the corner, kind of in the same room. It's just, they've become inseparable. Obviously, you know, at this point, we're not supposed to know they're the same person. So, but they just become inseparable almost straight away.
Great double act.
And drawn to each other. And actually, it's funny, like when your man was writing the book, Alan Yoke was writing the book, he didn't even know up until towards the end that he was going to make them be the same person. Yeah. He wrote the story as them as that way. And then it was just like, actually, there's so much here of the two of them acting similar in the same scenes, which is really, really cool. But I love how it just kept, how it kicks on now into getting something bigger beyond the two of them or the one of them, whatever you want to look at.
Yeah. Absolutely. So like, obviously the next few nights they're fighting in the parking lot again, and they get a few onlookers and people asking, can I be next? And around this time as well, we start to see the deterioration of Jack's work life. He starts turning up, doesn't give a shit and work anymore. He starts turning up to work with black eyes and stuff and just couldn't care. But Fight Club grows from the parking lot and moves into the basement of a pub. This is where they set the rules, and it's like, oh yeah, the 8 rules, and geez, I've learned them off by heart, seen it enough times, but everyone knows they're the first 2 rules. But then it's the last rule that is the best, where it's just like, if it's your first night at Fight Club, you have to fight. It's just like, it's just delivered fucking, oh yeah, like amazing, fucking amazing. The brutality of some of these fights in the next few scenes, just, and the rawness of them are fucking wonderful, and they're not shot stylistically at all. Those initial kind of fights, Fincher just kind of leaves the camera. It's just on a tripod, or it's just very slowly moving. And it's just, as I say, it's like regular Joes getting a chance to become fucking gods for 10 minutes and either pummel someone into oblivion or get your ass fucking handed to you. And it's not about winning or losing, you know, it's about a release from the pressures of the modern world, or through some old school fisticuffs. And Norton says, when the fight was over, nothing was solved, nothing mattered. Afterwards, they just all felt saved, which is fucking dark and twisted, and it's very hard hitting. What do you think about the fights? I just remember the sound design, the cinema,
The sound of the fucking wallop is just fucking, it's so raw, so vicious. But
getting smacked into the ground, yeah.
But that's what you'd see that, but then, you know, it's followed, it's not followed, and there's a bunch of people are cheering it on and stuff. But when it's finished, it's not like one guy pulled the other guy off, let me finish him, or like aggro. They finish, they both get up covered in blood, and they're like one guy, the guy loses the fight, and he looks up at the ground, and he's blood in his mouth, and he's smiling. You know what I mean?
Because it's delighted,
it's
yeah.
just, it's almost this fucking brotherly thing, and they all put, everybody's hugging after the fights, everybody's clapping everybody in the shoulder. There's no shun the loser, cheer the winner. You know, that's real. Fucking nice, and they all hug after they fight each other. You know, it's just, it is a release. There is rules. Someone can tap out, but you still beat the shit out of each other in between them. And it's, yeah, they're fucking raw and vicious as fuck. But again, like you said, it's, even though this is a part of the movie and it's a name of the movie, it's still not the main part of the movie. You know, it's still not the main focus.
The fights are actually a small part of the running time, which just harkens back to that. That showcasing from studio execs showcasing so much of it in the trailers, it's very little of the movie. Like, but everything is going swimmingly again until Marla gets involved again as Jack receives a call from Marla, and she informs him she's taken an overdose of Xanax, and Jack just leaves the phone on the hook and just like, yeah, just fuck that. But the next morning, Marla strolls into the kitchen, and it turns out that Tyler has gone and rescued her in a fantastic sequence when they're avoiding the cops who are being called to Marla's apartment, and he just drags her out. And as the cops go past, Brad Pitt's just little fucking dad. He's just ad-libbed on the spot. He's just the fucking coolest dude around. But Marla is there in the kitchen the next day, and Jack is obviously doesn't know what's going on. He's like, what the fuck are you doing here? And obviously she is very confused and pissed off and leaves. And that sets up then Tyler and Marla shagging incessantly. And poor Jack just has to listen to it. there's one hilarious scene that it just Brad Pitt's comedic fucking timing and comedic mind. Where Jack is walking past Tyler's room, and he just hears them banging away with fucking the groans and moans. And apparently they recorded ADR on those moans and groans for 3 days, which is fucking brilliant. But yeah, Jack peeks through the door, but Brad Pitt opens the door and he's like, what the fuck are you doing? He's like, nothing. But he's standing there, Adonis and all, pretty much in the fucking nip. But wearing a yellow fucking rubber glove that apparently was his idea. He was just like, it was his idea to wear that. And he just looks at him and just said, you want to finish her off? He's just like,
the studio wanted to take it out, to take that part out with the glove. Only they said the test audiences, it was the part that got the most laughs in the movie. It was that part with the glove. They're like, oh, well, I guess we'll just fucking leave it in. So it was like, how many parts when you think back, how many parts of this did the suits try to get involved and get fucking shown completely to be wrong? You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Wasn't there when the producers, 20th Century Fox, when she saw the original line, when after one of their Jagan sessions, where I think the line in this is, she says, I haven't been fucked like that since grade school, which I'm guessing in America is very, very young. But initially the line that was in, she said she just went, oh, and a cigarette. And she said, I want to have your abortion. And the studio exec said, fuck that. That is not going in. Fincher said, yeah, that's okay. I'll take it out, but you can't cut the next line. And then the next line, they're even more furious. And he's just like, no, fuck you. That stays in.
Yeah. They ask, could they change it back? He's like, okay, let's change it back to the abortion one. Is that no. You said,
Playing hardball. He's a fucking legend. But, yeah, so now Jack has turned up to work with bloodstained shirts and smoking and fucking emailing fucking crazy haikus to people around the office. He's just losing run of himself, doesn't give a shit. He gets a phone call from the cops informing him that dynamite was used in his apartment explosion, that it was possibly homemade. And that sets the plot off on a delicious path of, you know, suspicion about Tyler, which obviously sets up the reveal even more so. Then the guys go to make soap, and this is... it's just another brilliant, brilliant scene where they're shown breaking into a liposuction clinic, and they make soap by rendering fat. And essentially they're selling rich people their own fat asses back to them, which is just like, yeah, this is fucking great. But the plot then takes, well, not more serious, but this next scene starts to take a more serious, dark, slightly twisted turn when they're in the kitchen and Tyler pours pours that chemical powder and chemical burn onto Jack's hand and convinces him to like give up and let go, and saying he needs to hit rock bottom. And it's like, if it's only after we've lost everything that we're free to do anything. That statement, so I guess prevalent in addiction recovery, and the weight of it is felt in this. That was the first time it was a really unnerving scene, like really just like, what the fuck is going on here? This is Brad Pitt, man. He's taking a fucking dark turn. What are your thoughts on that? It's horrible. Visuals of it as well, which just, skin burning.
Yeah, yeah. It looks fucking so painful. Like, I can't imagine what chemical burns is like. And especially what the solution is to pour fucking vinegar over it to counteract it. Ugh. Like, ugh. Yeah, it's fuck vicious.
That. Yeah, and Jack's boss finds the rules of Fight Club in the printer machine. And this was a contentious thing on a rewatch. Because I think this movie came out in late November 99. But when this was screened for test audiences, it was earlier in the year, or maybe late 1998, some of the early test screenings. And this got a really big laugh, this next scene where Jack's boss, he finds the rules in the printer machine, and then Jack stands up and says, well, you should be careful now, because the person who, you know, it could be possible that the person that's responsible for that is a very dangerous individual that could, you know, may arrive to work with a semi-automatic gas-powered fucking rifle, you know, and pummel round after round into co-workers, and goes on and on and on. And that, you know, and then he says, or you could just stop bothering me with this shit. You know, got a really big laugh. But then in between that and the release, obviously, Columbine shooting happened. So they were there was strong pressure to take this out. But Fincher was just like, no, he felt it needed to be in the movie. So he fought tooth and nail to keep it in. But it's, watching it back, you're like going, Jesus Christ, that is, the context of that has changed immeasurably. Like,
you can't, you just can't have anything like that in a movie and stuff anymore, you know, unless it's the absolute focus, you know. I remember seeing something, I think it was in the OA, you know, the TV show, the OA, and they actually had a school shooting thing, but they had to make shooting almost the focus of it, you know, rather than, you can't joke about it or you can't make a comment about it because it's too close to the bone. But this was the first really big, wasn't it? The first, I'm not sure if it was the first, but the first big school shooting in America. I mean, they have them, unfortunately, they have them very regularly now. Mm. But to look back in it now and go, damn, like that was very close to when Columbine happened.
Yeah, close to the bone. Like, following on from this, it's at this point where Fight Club starts to ramp up a bit and they start getting homework assignments, and Tyler delivers speeches talking about like advertising has us chasing cars and clothes, working jobs we hate so we can buy shit we don't need, which again is that's pretty much part and parcel of our day-to-day lives. But it's and this is where like this next kind of quote is where it taps into what Chuck has said about kind of how we saw the characters in this novel to begin with. That they're like the middle children of history, that they have no purpose or place. They have no great war or depression. You know, they're not reaching for the stars. And then Brad Pitt says like, our great war is a spiritual war and a great depression is our lives. And it's like, it's just fucking hard hitting. This is like Generation Z, you know, the generation that grew, first generation to grow up with divorce and single parents as a norm in America. And that's that quote where he says, we've all been raised on television to believe that one day we'll all be millionaires and rock stars and movie gods, but we won't. And we're learning that and we're fucking pissed off. Basically, don't fuck with us. And it's, it's like, that's fucking hard hitting. But then some humor follows that straight away where they get their homework assignments. First one is to start a fight with a complete stranger and lose. It's just that seeing this in the cinema for the first time, I know there's a few different shots in the sequence, but just the guy trying to start a fight with the fucking priest is one of the funniest things.
I'm pretty sure, now I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure the priest is in one of the fight scenes. like in the Fight Club. I was looking at him because I'd only watched it on a couple of reviews, and so I was like,
scrawny guy.
I think that, yeah, I think he's in the Fight Club then after that, one of the scenes afterwards. I think he actually gets involved. I'd have to look it up and think, but I'm pretty sure it's the same dude. Because I think as well that it's the guy who starts the fight with him.
Yeah.
Is that, I'm not sure if that's your man, Tench, you know, fucking from, I'm not sure if that's the same guy, but he is the guy.
His name is Robert Paulson, you know, the guy who says that later on, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, obviously that's David Fincher as well.
Is he the guy that's in that fight then later on? With that guy,
I'm not sure if that's the same guy who fights the priest. So I'm pretty sure the priest is in the fight scene. But yeah, like it's I loved it. It's just fucking great. But I love these, but when they start getting their assignments, and then the assignments start getting bigger and bigger because Tyler Durden is now more in command of our character than Jack is. And it's just great the way it just starts to ramp up into unravel. What they call it, onto Project Mayhem, you know.
Yeah. Following that little funny sequence of their homework, we get possibly one of the single greatest scenes I've ever seen. It's a mix of hilarity and brutality and madness, and it's just so fucking clever. It's when Jack goes to his boss's office and tries to extort him by saying that he knows the car components that they're putting in cars or whatever don't meet the regulations, and tries to blackmail his boss to give him a salary while he works at home, and he's totally just like, as if that'll work, and his boss tells him go fuck himself, whatever. And then Jack proceeds to actually beat the living shit out of himself, throwing himself through tables and shelves, thumping himself repeatedly. And all the while, the boss is called security, and there's just that beautiful moment of pure fucking magical timing as the security guards enter, and Jack is at the feet of his boss, holding his boss's hands with his bloody hands, and just say, "Please don't hit me anymore." Then the next scene is him walking out with his stuff, like happy as Larry after getting his what he wanted. I can remember seeing that scene for the first time in cinemas. Do you?
Yeah. It's a big fucking smile on his face, blood down his face, the security are escorting him out, and he just has this smug look and fucking, yeah, it's great.
We ramp up the assignments, and Project Mayhem takes effect. Goes from smashing satellite dishes and doing all sorts to getting a bit crazier. And we do have a scene where Tyler grabs a convenience store worker and in a not so much a lighter tone, but he basically asks the convenient worker, "What did you want to be in life?" And the guy says he's a vet, and he's crying his eyes out, and says, "Well, in 6 weeks I'm going to come back, and if you're not on your way to becoming a vet, you'll be dead." It's just like, oh, is this not a lighter side, but is there an essence of poignancy in there somewhere, just like by some dastardly means? But it's
I still found that a little bit tough to watch. I still found it tough to watch because, you know, the all the guys who've gone into Fight Club have all done so of their own accord. They've all gone in, they've been told the rules, they know what's happening, and they've all gone in voluntarily. And that's how they're changing their life. They're going in and getting peace, getting release, getting this stuff. They all join in when later on, when they have to stand on the step, you know, for 3 days or whatever, before they all know what they're getting in for. Whereas there was something different in this scene where this guy is literally being terrified. He didn't ask for any of this, but he's being terrified into it. Brad Pitt or Tyler Durden or whoever is trying to act like he's doing a good thing. I'm going to scare this guy into taking the path that he really wants to take, because the only thing holding him back is, you know, is himself. And so I'll give him the fear. But there was something so different about this character. He didn't sign up for that. He didn't want to be involved. He would ever, and it's not anybody else's place to try and change that. I think that it really stands out as a different, and you can see then this is when Ed Norton, who is obviously the other side of the character, he's completely disturbed by this. He's like, "What the fuck are you doing? What are you doing? Yeah. Stop getting the story. Is that a gun? What the hell's going on?" There's part of him that still sees how different this is than what they've been doing so far, you know?
Yeah, and Tyler Durden, the way he justifies it, saying, you know, when he wakes up in the morning, his breakfast will be the best food that he's ever eaten. It'll be the best day of his life, as if he's doing him a fucking favor. Yeah,
echo your thoughts on that completely. He's a god.
So twisted.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas he, as if he's some god and he's giving him as a gift. Whereas now this guy could wake up tomorrow with fucking PTSD. This guy could blow his own brains out. He could go into absolute full on shock and have to go and see a psychiatrist because did this happen? Did it not happen? What? It's, you know, this, what Tyler Durden said, this is how I do it. I shock people into the world. This is what the world needs. It needs chaos in order to heal and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, there's an arrogance to it, you know? But it's great. It is a great scene, but I still find it tough to watch. This guy's just crying his eyes out, you know? He's an innocent.
He acts it really well, yeah. And then, yeah, like Tyler then starts making bunk beds and people start moving in. And applicants, you know, they're saying staying at the house for 3 days outside with no food or sleep. And this part really showcased why Fight Club attracts so many legions of dedicated members looking for, I guess, meaning or purpose or whatever, leading father figure or such. But it showcases how, like, these rudderless fucking people can be manipulated into taking part in some despicable actions. And, you know, the cult status of this really comes to the fore when they shave their heads and start dressing the same, following commands without hesitation. And it's at the time, you know, so I guess it's on repeat watching. So you're just going, fucking hell, it's an absolute cult and a dark window into how people can fall so easily into something like this when they're searching for something fundamentally missing from their lives, I guess. It's fucking, it's dark and it does take, it just gets quite dark after this, and he's building an army, and it's just, as Jack's saying, what's the purpose of the army? And it's in Jack they trust, you know. And they start having grander acts of vandalism throughout this Project Mayhem. Jack starts to feel a bit disillusioned and out of sync with what's happening. And he takes this annoyance out on Jared Leto's character in a scene that I think was censored in the UK heavily. He beats Jared Leto's character within an inch of his life. It's such a brutal beatdown. Pummels him over and over.
Wet punches, like it just fucking bad.
The look on the crunching faces of, squelches, like, oh, fuck.
And it's the look on the faces of the other guys, because they've all been, for whatever amount of time, have been going to these fights and all watching these fights. They're no stranger to violence, because this is what they do. They go to Fight Club, they watch people beat the shit out of each other, but they're looking on in horror because he's breaking the rule. He's tapped out, he's already down, he's unconscious, you're not supposed to keep hitting him.
Stop.
So he's breaking the rule, but what do we do? He's the boss, he's the guy who started it, so he can't say anything. But they're looking on in fear and maybe even a bit of disgust at what's happening, and shock, and like the line of, I just felt like destroying something beautiful.
What a line. You know?
Yeah, and because it's Tyler Durden, for once, is the voice of reason, because he's walking past, and Tyler is like, so are you going on fucking psycho? Yeah, you going psycho? And he's like, I just felt like destroying something beautiful. And it's probably one of the only parts in the movie where Tyler is the force of chill the fuck out, man.
Mm.
You know, and it's, yeah.
Tyler's
it's
words coming out of Jack's mouth, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is essentially, yeah. So, yeah, Jack and Tyler then have it out in an amazing car sequence, where Jack feels like he hasn't been kept informed enough and says, you know, Fight Club it's both of ours. And Tyler said it doesn't belong to them anymore. And Tyler starts to veer into oncoming traffic and just let go of the wheel. And a great fucking music score starts to come in. And Jack obviously grabs the wheel and he's just screaming at him, just fucking let go, man. Just let go. And then he confesses that he blew up his fucking condo. Just says, just fucking let go. And Jack agrees, and then they strap in, that little moment where they've just let go and they just both put on their seatbelts, and it's like, fuck, this is amazing. And they strap in, the car crashes and veers off. Jack wakes up back at the house and Tyler's gone. And Jack says to himself, it's a lovely quote, he says, I'm all alone. My father dumped me. Tyler dumped me. I'm Jack's broken heart. He's like, here we go. And there's, he gets up and there's commotion in the house as one of their men is brought back dead and a gunshot to the head, and that is Bob, or dear beloved bitch tit Bob, Jack's first friend from the self-help groups. Jack obviously freaks out. And this is another point where it's like that kind of cult mentality where they're just like, let's bury him. And Jack's trying to say, no, he's got a fucking name. Like, this is Bob. Like, because he obviously has a deep connection to this guy. And they're like, you know, in Project Mayhem, you don't have a name. And he's like, he does have a name. It's Robert Paulson. And they shift their beliefs to fit their narrative. They're just like, oh, okay, well,
yeah.
Oh, well, maybe in death you have a name. And just, you know, it's like fucking any cult where it's just if anything is opposed to them, that's different than the norm. They can easily just shift gears and just, oh, yeah, no, okay, that's the way. And just continue on with your, as if nothing's happened. Like his name is Robert Paulson. It's just fucking.
Yeah, chanting it. Like
it's just, yeah. It's fucking very eerie. Then we speed on that Jack travels around to various cities after finding some folders with numerous addresses and ticket stubs. And he says another line where he's saying that he just knows when he goes to a city, he just knows by looking at bars which bar Tyler's been in. He just has an idea. It's just like, well, that's because you were in the fucking bar. He goes in and meets a barman who he's chatting to, and then barman says, well, you know, well, you were here last Thursday checking security or whatever. And Jack asks him, what do you mean? Like, who do you think I am? Because he's looking for Tyler Durden. And he's like, is this a test, sir? It's like, who do you think I am? And it's just like, you're Mr. Durden. And then you get this lovely quote, which is, please return your seat backs to their full upright and locked positions. Because like, here we fucking go. And Jack and Tyler come to a head in Jack's hotel room. And they kind of have it out, and it cuts to the chase. And Tyler says, well, why do people think that I'm you? And I think you know why. And Jack's revelation, you see it in his face. He's just like, well, because we're the same person. And it's just like, I just remember seeing that at the time. It's just, you don't see it coming. As you had said earlier with Chuck, like he didn't know it was coming. So there's no, it's like foreshadowing in some of the dialogue, but there's nothing that leads itself that this
it's easy to say it now. You know, everybody knows it now, and it's easy to see it if someone was to watch it and say, oh, well, you know, you kind of, I knew it, and you can see all these telltales. I mean, you can say that now, but at the time, if you're seeing it for the very first time, I'd never heard anything about the movie, you don't know. You know, I mean, you're engrossed in these two characters and the relationship that they have. You don't fucking know. Actually, just as an aside, did you read that bit of trivia about that fucking cunt, pardon my French, Rosie O'Donnell?
Oh, so she did something live on TV.
Yeah, she saw it, had seen a preview or had seen it and said, and was disturbed by it, and told her on her talk show, and told as many people, I told her audiences and stuff, gave away the plot, as in these guys are the same person. I gave away the plot and told people not to watch it.
Completely missing the point of the movie, yeah.
Dickhead. What a fucking dickhead. Like, it's none of your business to ruin art for anybody else, you absolute wagon. Yeah. God, it's like coming out of the fucking Sixth Sense and telling people exactly, you know, it's why take it away from other people just because you don't like it? I hate this shit. Yeah. I don't like it, so no one else gets to fucking like it. I'm derailing. Oh. We're already longer in this episode than we did in the whole of the last episode, so I'll stop derailing it. So.
But we see numerous flashbacks to showing that when Tyler and Jack were in the same scene, it was actually just Jack and viewpoints of Tyler. It was actually Jack in his place. Jack then discovers the plans to plant explosives in numerous locations, and he meets Marla, tells her he's sorry, and tells her to get out of town because she knows too much and Tyler has bad plans for her. He discovers a van at one of the buildings. Jack and Tyler fight it out. We say there's some hilarious shots. CCTV during this, where it's just this, they're having this battle in camera, and then you cut to the CCTV and it's just Ed Norton beating the shit out of himself and eventually throwing himself down the stairs, which is a fantastic stunt. Kudos to the stuntman on that one. And now we're back where we came in at the beginning of the movie, the top floor of a high-rise building. Jack tied to a chair with a pistol in his mouth. Jack looks out and sees some guys bringing Marla into the building, and he's start pleading with Tyler saying, you know, just let her go. They have a back and forth. Tyler saying, you know, look how far we've come. You're like, look, since I've been around, look how far we've come together. You know, do you want to go back to your shitty fucking life? And then Jack begins to take control and realizes, a lovely shot where Tyler's in the background with the gun in his hand. And Jack goes, well, the gun's not in your hand. It's in my hand. He looks down and then It's in his hand, goes back to Brad, and there's nothing in his hand. It's very fucking nice. Puts a gun in his mouth and says, I want you to really listen to me, Tyler. And says, my eyes are open. And then just, and you don't, again, you just didn't think he's going to fucking shoot himself, and then proceeds to just shoot himself in the fucking, in the head. Well, technically out the side of his face, behind his fucking jaw.
Yeah.
But it was a total holy fuck moment that you just like, just don't think it's going to happen. And it goes in line with the whole movie. You know, you never know what was going to happen in the next scene, let alone in the scene you're in 5 minutes from now, 10 seconds from now. It's just so thrilling. Like that shot and the effects of that shot and the kind of bulging kind of cheek as a bullet fucking, yeah, flies through him is just fantastic. Tyler drops dead to the floor and Jack slumps back in the chair, side of his face hanging off. Guys arrive at Marla and Jack just tells Marla he shot himself, but everything's going to be fine, trust me. And then the Pixies music starts to slowly come in, and just like, even the 11th time I watch it, it's from multiple moments during the film, but it's like, I can't wait to be in a cinema to watch this ending with all these people who haven't fucking seen it. It's one of those moments.
Yeah.
And it's Pixies music comes in. They look out the window of the building and we see numerous buildings around them explode and collapse out the window. And Jack turns to Marla, holds her hand and delivers an absolute killer fucking final line. You have met me at a very strange time in my life. Understatement of the fucking year. And we fade to black with obviously a spliced cock put in just for effect. And so ends, you know, this fucking masterpiece with one of the greatest final scenes in memory. Just like thoughts on that. It just, just still got me watching it yesterday. Just fucking unbelievable.
It's even getting me now, even thinking about it.
Just get chills.
It's just beautiful. Yeah. Him, yeah. The two of them there, him reaching out and taking her hand. And as you said, the music swelling. It's just, it's a fucking incredible movie. And it's an amazing end to it as well. And I love that it's, there's so much, I don't agree with some of it, but there's so much read into it as well. Some people believe that Marla is all in his head as well, which I don't agree with. But a lot of it's, there's so much, as I said, you can pick up as you watch this movie that you haven't seen the last time. And it leaves a lot of things open for people to kind of decide for themselves. And it's so amazingly shot, like I said, where, you know, when the only time where other people are actually talking directly to Tyler Durden are kind of when Ed Norton is doing the fourth wall break, when he's talking to the thing and telling you about Tyler Durden's life. Then in the background, the girl from the soap is talking directly to him. People are recognizing him. But generally, you know, they're talking to one or the other. The two of them are there. There's a guy that gets on the bus and he kind of brushes past Tyler, doesn't say anything, even though he bumps off him. But once he bumps off Ed Norton, he goes, excuse me. You know, it's just little things like that that are throughout the movie, where people are talking to Tyler but directing their eyes and speech toward Ed Norton. So watching it back, you pick up on loads, and it's just, that's what makes it such a wonderful movie to rewatch.
Yeah.
You know, there's tons of movies I'll rewatch and I'll almost watch them on autopilot. I've seen them so many times. I know the scenes inside out that I can look away or even look at my phone and I can still picture the scene in my head. Whereas rewatching for this, I'm kind of looking out for shit that I might not have seen before. It's just, as you said before, I think it's an absolute masterpiece of a movie. It's incredible.
Absolutely. And when we talked earlier about like, revisiting something like this, and when something is 25 years old, as we were saying, the visual effects hold up. But generally, with older movies, I comment on kind of society or the times or society at the time, is that they will feel a little outdated when you watch them back. But apart from some of the music and, you know, one or two visual effect shots, the alarming thing is that it maybe seems even more prevalent now, 25 years later.
Yeah.
Like the epitome of a movie before its time. It's just phenomenal fucking movie. Phenomenal.
Yeah, it's mad to think this was made before social media was ramming shit down your throat, telling you all the things you needed in your life, how you're supposed to look, as you said, that you're going to be a rock star, rock god. Da, da, da. I mean, that's exactly what's forced down throughout my fucking TikTok, Instagram, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, this was coming out, I suppose, fucking 5-6 years before, you know, we even got
before mobile
Facebook or anything like that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's, we were only fucking texting at the time. Thought we were cool texting. Like, are you coming out tonight? No, I'm Jack's complete lack of surprise. You know, this kind of stuff. It was, it's a movie at a time, but one that should be, you know, watched by any generation now. It's fantastic.
Absolutely. And that wraps up our movie review. Woo-loo-loo-loo, yay! On to Phil now with some retro corner action.
Right, okay, look, yeah, retro corner, I'm going to try and burn through this because it's such a departure from what we've just discussed, going from the kind of the grimy and dark and cerebral nature of that movie into something incredibly lighthearted. So for this, for the retro corner this week, we're going to be looking back at the 1999, obviously, classic Donkey Kong 64. So I picked this one firstly because I love the character, because there's a new game coming out as well. But also because it's not, when we do these retro games, a lot of time I'm just talking about how amazing they are. But this was one that was amazing, but also had its issues. So look, I'll fly through it maybe 10 minutes. I'd like to hear a bit of your bit of feedback from yourself as well. So this was another one from Rare. We discussed Rare when we talked about Conker's Bad Fur Day in the first episode. So obviously another one to their a string to their bow of fucking fantastic games. So look, a good game, very different from its predecessors in some ways, in that it actually has some 3D gameplay. Whereas, you know, actually now that I think about it, it might even be the only 3D Donkey Kong game. I never played Tropical Crush. Did you play Tropical Crush? That one?
Yeah,
that's a 2D
side scroller.
Okay,
yeah.
I have actually played that one. So I think it is the only one that had 3D in it. And it was essentially a 3D platformer, which is what, you know, which was starting to become some of their bread and butter with Banjo-Kazooie and Conker and stuff. But Conker came out after this one. But like, I think for the time, it was quite a long game. It was like 25 or 30 hours long. Which was a lot for a game then, especially on the N64. You know, that wasn't the game that isn't called Zelda. But like, I think the thing is that it was fleshed out with a lot of mini games. And when we get to kind of some of the bad stuff, you'll see why this is an issue. You know, did you play this one when it came out? Or
yeah, I think I remember because it was you needed the expansion pack on the 64.
Yeah,
it was one of those. It just would not run. I don't know if it did ship. Is this one of the first games that shipped with the expansion pack?
It did ship with it. Yeah. This I think Conker shipped with it. I mean, Perfect Dark might have been another one, or maybe Perfect Dark didn't need it, but you could use it. But yeah, it did ship with the expansion pack, which was mad. I remember when you worked in the video game store, and those things were like gold dust trying to get them.
Couldn't get one.
Yeah. So the difference in this one as well is that they introduced more characters, so you weren't just Donkey and Diddy Kong. There was now Cranky, Chunky, Tiny, and Lanky. You know, and they all had their own special abilities. lazy names like but they all had their own special abilities, and you'd need certain ones to complete certain puzzles as you go through the game. And so the premise is basic, kind of generic. Like it's that Donkey Kong and his mates are trying to stop this plans of this evil crocodile guy who's one of the bosses in the Donkey Kong series, King K. Rool. And I can't remember what his evil plan was, but it was definitely something generic. But the characters, like, is where it shines. Like, there's a lot of personalities in these individual characters, which is something that runs through those games. You know, the humor really comes through, like in Conker and in Banjo and stuff. The personality really comes through, and it's no different in here. The puzzles were fun. They were handy enough, but it was all just the usual moving, rearranging, shooting targets, that kind of crap. But did you remember this step, which was a bit different, was you could actually do the stuff in different order. So because the other ones are platformers, it was really linear. You know, was from this scene to the next scene to the next scene. Whereas this one, there was certain zones, but you could do them in different orders, and you could warp from one district to the other. And obviously that's commonplace in games now. But for Donkey Kong, this was something completely different. You couldn't do that before. Which is wild, because I'm pretty sure you could do that the likes of fucking Super Mario 2. You know, you could go and Super Mario 3. You could do stuff in different order.
Yeah.
But this was all the way to the N64 before we got it in a Donkey Kong game.
That's bananas, actually.
Bananas, exactly. and but as usual, there's a forest level and a jungle level. And of course, as all these fucking games, there's a water level. Now, I feel like you get that. You remember that from that time, from that right way back to our fucking NES game, SNES. There was always a fucking water level. Sonic, cool. Everything. They just insisted on platformers having a water level.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And
is this one, yeah, this one does, it's where you, especially with Donkey Kong, once where you have to time back to get from one barrel to another, and it levels like that are always well and good. And back in the day, they were so unforgiving. You know what I mean? It's just like sometimes you just, it's a shot in the dark, and you're kind of going, if you're not fucking right on the edge of this fucking platform, you're in the water. And as we know, like the save points weren't as generous back then. So you get one misstep and you're fucking, that's why water levels are horrible, because it's just going back now, especially because it's so tough.
And if they're running out of water, like, especially as you get that in Sonic, you'd have to fucking go and you just get a bubble and then you're certain one, and your fucking per character starts glowing blue, fucking going blue. Like, for fuck's sake. I think it was only until recently where I actually got an underwater level I loved, which was the gorgeous underwater casino level in Horizon Forbidden West.
Oh, yeah, that's where you're going. Pretty.
That is, and it's just the neon lights, and you're, as you pick up those little things that are telling the story of your man who's walking around shutting the place down, that kind of made me love a bit of water level. But this was like fucking did my head in this game.
It's because it's so timed, you know, when your oxygen is timed and it's frantic, you can't really take in, like, if in Horizon you were fucking gasping for air every moment, you're not going to take in the beauty of the level.
Yeah,
the level design goes to hell.
So as you go through this one, then you're unlocking all those characters I mentioned. You unlock them as you go through the game, and you use these collectible bananas that are around the place. So there's like regular bananas for one thing, and each different character has a different color banana. And the idea is that you're picking these up as you go along. Like it reviewed pretty well. Like IGN gave it a 9, Edge gave it a 10. I think it still has a Metacritic of 90 out of 100, which is great. And it came out in, like, it came out the end of 99, so it was just in time for the holiday season. So obviously it sold a bundle at the time, but I think overall it wasn't a great seller. Like overall, I think in the lifetime of the game, it sold like 2.3 million, which when you consider that next to, say, Zelda, now when I was Zelda, Ocarina is obviously a bigger game, but Ocarina sold 7.5 million. And the fact that Donkey Kong is so much more accessible for different people than getting stuck into a massive game like Zelda, you would think it would do better.
He's a more recognizable character as well.
He's a character since fucking decades before. You know, people were playing Donkey Kong in the arcades and everything. You know, I think maybe it came down to one of the major gripes with the game, which became something, unfortunately, that Rare became known for with later games, and that was these forced collectibles, backtracking to get them. Like, it's not like it is now, where if you're playing Spider-Man and you're swinging through the city, you can go and you can pick up a certain amount of like backpacks or a certain amount of different things, and you can use them to get like very cosmetic kind of stuff to it. If you want to go and do the missions, you can, or you can just fucking ignore it and do the main mission. It's up to you which way you want to do it. But in here, you had to do it. They were forced to collect it because they weren't secondary to the main mission. You needed to do these because you had to collect them in order to get access to boss fights, in order to get access to the next level, in order to unlock abilities for your characters so that you could solve these mini things. You had to go back and collect all these fucking bananas so that you could purchase stuff and upgrade them. And it just made it such a fucking slog. So like, even if you were someone who loves collectibles, you shouldn't have to collect them to get through to the next part of the game. And that was really annoying. Like, if you think of something like Mario Odyssey does it quite well. So for Mario Odyssey, you know, it's very easy to get the amount that you need to go on to the next level because you're just basically trying to power your ship. But they make it really interesting to find the little moons. You know, you go and you have to complete a little task to unlock it, or you time a few things right and you unlock another little moon and you start collecting them. In this, you're forced to do it just to get on to the next part of the game.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's where it kind of fell down for me a little bit, and maybe where it doesn't stand the test of time. Like, you go back to like Donkey Kong Country or Mario 64, even fucking Mario on the SNES, like these games stand the test of time because they're still a lot of fun. But because of how games evolve now, going back into this fucking forced collecting really makes this one not stand up for me. Like, I wouldn't go back and play this game again because of that, you know?
Yeah. I imagine that's probably probably a reason I don't think I completed the game when it came out. That's my memory of it anyway. I do remember when it came out and just the the buzz around it. But yeah, you're right. It did die quite quickly. And it's, for a game that got a 9, it's very rarely on the top 20, top 50 Nintendo games.
Yeah,
you know, it exactly. was gorgeous at the time, but there's, I do remember, like, there was a lot of frame rate issues with it because I think they were punching over a bit above their weight. We've got the expansion pack that boosts the memory and all this stuff, but it was measly, what is it, 32 megs or whatever it was extra at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah,
it wasn't that much of a graphical boost over Banjo-Kazooie or Mario or any of these games around that time. It was just,
they
looked prettier.
Conker came out a couple of years later using expansion pass and looks fucking so much better. Mm, but 100%. Still, the world for what it was, a lot of the worlds did look good. The humor was good enough to make a playthrough enjoyable. But like it suffered again from like the camera angles too. Like the camera angles of that were in Banjo-Kazooie that they didn't fix for this. They didn't fucking fix for Conker either. I'm not sure why Rare didn't bother their arses with that when it was something that so stood out the whole time in feedback and from reviews and stuff. But look, that's it. I just wanted to run through it just because of the fact that it was one, and it was the major Donkey Kong game, really, that was on the N64, and because it was one of the last games that Rare made. Like, this was the last time Rare were able to make a Donkey Kong game after making so many successful ones. They weren't given access to make any more because this one just wasn't a home run, unfortunately. But like, it's still, I would recommend for anybody who maybe hasn't played it to go on and look at a lot of the fucking YouTube videos, because the story, like, of the characters and their interaction, the humor is still funny. So worth having a go. I think maybe if you have a Wii U emulator, it came out on the Wii U, you could probably play it. But yeah, that's a quick whistle stop through a 25-year-old game that, you know, maybe I think has a higher score than it probably deserved. But still kind of stands out. It is still one of the ones, still a great a decent game, and
it's nice to see like 2D characters, you know, being brought into 3D. It's quite nice.
It didn't like when Mario did it. It was holy shit, this is insane. Mario 64 was wow. Whereas I think they wanted this to happen for Donkey Kong, another one of Nintendo's huge characters, but it didn't really come off. But yeah, look, that's it for the retro corner. I absolutely love talking through that movie with you, Daz. It's an absolute fucking classic that, you know, I will imagine I'll be watching, you know, once a year forever. You know, it's just an absolute classic that everybody should watch. So like next week, guys, we'll continue on with more 25-year-old madness in our 1999, Party Like It's 1999. And next year, we're going to be doing something a little more upbeat. I am going to do Office Space. Classics. Just, you know, it's just so solidified in geek culture. It's been parodied so many times. Great performances, understated performances. It's going to be a lot of fun to talk and laugh through that next week when we go through it. And Daz, I think I know what game you're doing next week. Do you want to share or do you want to save it for next week?
Be surprised.
Okay, excellent. Okay. Well, look, Daz, is there anything else you want to say before we finish up?
No, just love that. Yeah, love chatting about these movies and old games with you, buddy. It's great fucking buzz. Great fun.
Yeah.
I can't wait for Office Space. Cannot wait.
Deadly. Yeah, look, and thanks to you guys for listening along or watching along. Again, keep sending your feedback in to middleagegeeksyahoo.com. You know, follow us. We're all on all social medias, although I haven't put anything really on TikTok. But look, follow us, send us in any feedback you have. Maybe at the start of next week, we'll kind of get through. And because I know, Daz, you have some there from some previous episodes. We'll do like a little mailbag thing at the start of next week and get through some of the feedback we haven't addressed yet. But keep it coming. Like, subscribe, share, all that good stuff. And from me and from Daz, thanks for listening, and we will speak to you again next week. Take it easy.
See you later.